Well, it's February 20th, 2024 of the Common Era. The time is 22:55 hours Eastern Standard Time. Getting late. Eastern Time, as they call it. 22:55 hours. Ward Green with you again today for the study. From this time, it's... And I remember to resize the window this time, so it's easier to read it. But I apologize for the inset or the side bar here, which overlaps the text. You won't see it looking that bad in a wide view on a bigger monitor, but or on a wider view. It's got to do with the size of the text partly too. I've made the text very large. But anyway, it's chapter 6, paragraph 11 of the Crucible of Credible Creed, article C3. And the daughter of Pharaoh, Apophis, was called Thermuthis by the first century historian, Mr. Flavius Josephus. If you haven't read the preceding paragraphs in the article, The Crucible of Credible Creed, from 2012, by Ward Green, Rolf Ward Green. My birth given name was Ralph. I noted that some of my ancestors had slightly modified their names in the spelling, so I took liberty with my own name and called myself Rolf Ward Green as the author, as my pen name. Now, you may want, or you may feel free to read the previous chapters and other articles also written prior to this and after this article by yours truly. Now, Mr. Flavius Josephus was the one who called the daughter of Apophis Thermuthis, and he was writing when he said that in the work of his called Antiquities of the Jews, Book 2, Chapters 9 and 10. The Book 2 and chapter numbers probably are later, or possibly later editorial assignments, because we see in the works of these ancient authors there are different designations for the chapter numbers and the book numbers sometimes. You have to be aware of that. It's not always going to be the same. And it could be hard to find things because of that. But Eusebius of Caesarea calls the daughter of Apophis Maris. Maris. M-E-R-R-I-S. And Eustathius of Antioch gives her the name Merho. Compare with the city Mero, or Meroe. I guess it's an Egyptian city, I believe it is, based on my recollection, which is not always reliable. But Merho, her name. Other names for her are Bithia. But the thing is, okay, the other thing is, if you want to compare with, if we want to compare with Manetho, I'm looking for the Manethan text here. Where is it? Do I have it? I had it here. I know I did. It's somewhere here. I'll look for it. I believe it's here. Anyway, we'll search for it here. It's not well labeled anymore. The Manethan text. I'm trying to remember the name of Hatshepsut in Manetho. Well, I think maybe it's here. No. Here it is. I found it. Okay. It's one of these two. It's the second one of these two. This is the one here. This is Fotheringham, the chronology of the Old Testament. Either that or it's Manetho by Waddell, 1940. So there, this is the chronology of the Old Testament by Fotheringham. And in that, on page whatever it was, where are we? Now I've jumped down. Here it is, 122. Page 122. Ameses or Amersis is the name of Hatshepsut. So just to compare with Maris, which is the name just mentioned for the daughter of Apophis, who we also noted was called Herit in our own usage of her name. But it's interesting. What was Maris, Mero, but compared to Amersis or Amesis, for the queen, the pharaoh Hatshepsut, coming back to our article of, where is it? Here we are. We've got to get a move going on here. We've got to move on quickly. At 1 Chronicles 4 and 18, she appears to be called the Jewish wife of Caleb. That name Bithia, but we don't believe that she lived any time near the time of Caleb. That was, or is that true? No, yeah, that's right. Well, she did, that's right. She lived at the time of Moses, when Moses, but that was in 15-something. It's not really near at all. 1573, the birth of Moses, so 1572, whenever the exact date we have for that, 1572 or 3 BCE for the birth of Moses, when Pharaoh's daughter was there and adopted him, compared to 1452 for the time when Caleb was getting older, and or the time of 1493 when Caleb was in his 40s. So, you know, I think we know that pretty accurately, but let's just say for now, roughly in his 40s, so we don't make a mistake there. But in which she happens to be called the Jewish wife of Caleb. And Bathia in the book of Jasher, both having the meaning of daughter of Jehovah, like, for example, Bat-Yah in Hebrew, and the Arabic name Asiya, meaning helper of the weak, or Asiya. The Arab tradition says that she was named Asiya and that she was a believer in the quote-unquote new religion of her day, a Hebrew, that she was a Hebrew. Asiya, the wife of Pharaoh, quote-unquote wife of Pharaoh, in the Quran, she remains nameless. She remains nameless in the Quran. Mr. Josephus makes, of course, no mention of the Pharaoh's name either, but he does relate that Moses went to war in Egypt's battle against the Ethiopians and was victorious. So we have somewhat of a good reference there in Josephus regarding the battle against the Ethiopians, and that Moses was victorious in that battle. In Antiquities, which is Josephus again, the Ethiopians first come north into Egypt as far as Memphis. Quote, as far as Memphis and the sea itself, I don't see the closing quote there. But the text is obstructed. Which means into the northern kingdom of Egypt under Pharaoh Apophis. Well, that's interesting. Yeah, in Antiquities, you see, Josephus says the Ethiopians come north into Egypt as far as the northern kingdom. So that may be why Moses fought against them. But we also know that the mother of Moses had some connection with the southern kingdom of Egypt, because we note that the vase was, a vase associated with her was found in the grave of Amenhotep, the first Egyptian pharaoh who was ruling during the life of, another one who ruled during the life of Moses. The book of Jasher says that Moses was 18 years old when he killed the Egyptian. Book of Jasher says, okay, and fled to Ethiopia. Well, that's different. The Bible says he was 40 when he fled to Ethiopia. Now, this is fascinating that the book of Jasher says he was 18 years old. Is it not, little children? When he killed the Egyptian and fled to Ethiopia. Well, he fled to Ethiopia, okay. According to the book of Jasher, he didn't flee to Midian, but to Ethiopia, which differs from the Bible. finding there the camp of a certain king, Kikianus, who was outside of his own city, Kikianus, it having the king Kikianus, it having been taken over, this city, during the king's time away at war with Aram, and now he tried to enter his city. When Moses was 18, it was 1554 BCE in our chronology, born 1572. And Pharaoh Apophis was the northern king of Egypt. We get 18 plus 1554 equals 1572. As far as the date and Moses' age, while his daughter, of Apophis, the daughter, had perhaps married the southern pharaoh at an earlier date in peace. The story of the Ethiopian exploits of Moses ends with him marrying a Cushite woman and ruling Ethiopia for 40 years. By this time, he's 67 years old and goes to Midian. This is all from the other story of Moses. I'm not sure if it's all in the book of Jasher either. The time remaining, let's see, 9 and 10. Yeah, book of Jasher. 9 and 10. It's from the book of Jasher. The time remaining being 13 years before the Exodus, on the way to which his Midian wife circumcises their son. That is, on the way to the Exodus, on the way back from Midian to Egypt. Okay. I have so many things I want to talk about, but there's no time. There must be many questions by many people, I would think, as to why is our chronology better than every other chronology, for example? Why? How? How could it be that one person could be knowing more than everyone else in all the scholarly world? And it's a combination of different things. For example, using the Bible, which is God's own word, but also having qualifications that assist me in doing astronomical calculations. For example, I've earned a master's in physics, in experimental physics, and also I have a bachelor's degree in engineering physics. I have some basic skills with, you know, rudimentary things like, you know, not the most advanced mathematics, but a lot of mathematics I can do. The Ethiopian people has a tradition of Moses as marrying, ruling there, and a line of kings from the Ethiopian wife. That's the other thing. There's a line of kings that came from the Ethiopian wife. The name of this and his Cushite wife is Tharbas, according to Mr. Josephus, and Moses led the Egyptians back to their place. So he went back to Egypt after that, even though he ruled there for a time, according to that tradition. That's 11 and 12. That's from, again, well, that's from Antiquities of the Jews by Josephus. Josephus lived, of course, hundreds and hundreds, more than 1,000 years after Moses. He lived in the time of the writing of this Antiquities of the Jews is about 93 of the Common Era. So in the first century of the Common Era, after Christ, who was crucified in 30 CE in our chronology, which appears to be the true chronology based on all the evidence that we have compiled at great length and great detail with great pains. And when I say we, I'm referring to myself, because it's just simpler to say we, because there are many, many contributors to the chronology through the ancient authors, and as we see from that chapter there. That's the end of today's study. It's remarkable how much. You can see how you could spend your whole life studying the Cushite tradition of Moses or something like that. It's very detailed, and we don't have time to do it all in one day. Proverbs 20, and we will hopefully come back to all of these things in detail, like the book of Daniel. We need to come back to it in more detail later. We're just going to read it for now if we can. Wine is a ridiculer, Proverbs 20 and 1, but today's scripture is from 20 and 4. Because of winter, the lazy one will not plow, But he will be begging in reaping time, but there will be nothing. Because of winter, lazy ones will not plow. They will be begging in reaping time, but there will be nothing. That's our scripture, little ones, for today. Let's look at our reading for today from 1 Chronicles 10. It's very short, which is fortunate. And we're finally through the list of genealogies, and we're now into the text, which corresponds exactly to the events in the books of Kings. And the Philistines, for their part, made war upon Israel. And the men of Israel went fleeing from before the Philistines and kept falling slain in Mount Gilboa. And the Philistines kept in close range of Saul and his sons. And the Philistines got to strike down Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua, sons of Saul. And the fighting became heavy against Saul. And those shooting with the bow finally found him, and he got wounded by the shooters. Then Saul said to his armor bearer, draw your sword. I'm choking on the smoke. It's not too smoky, but I can tell there's a little smoke in the air. I'm going to turn on my thing, my HEPA filter, as soon as I'm done. Draw your sword and run me through with it, that these uncircumcised men may not come and certainly deal abusively with me. Saul said to his armor bearer, kill me. In other words, with my sword, or with your sword. And his armor bearer was unwilling because he was very much afraid. So Saul took the sword and fell upon it. He fell upon his own sword, and when his armor bearer saw that Saul had died, then he too fell upon the sword and died. Thus Saul and three sons of his died, and all those of his house died together. When all the men of Israel that were in the low plain saw that they had fled, and that Saul and his sons had died, then they began to leave their cities and flee. After which the Philistines came on in and took up dwelling in them. And it came about the next day that when the Philistines came to strip the slain, they got to find Saul and his sons fallen upon Mount Gilboa. And they proceeded to strip him and take off his head and his armor, and send into the land of the Philistines all around to inform their idols and the people. They believed their idols actually had knowledge, but their idols were just false gods, idol gods. I mean, carvings or representations out of wood and stone and, precious metal. Finally, they put his armor in the house of their god, Saul's armor, that is, and his skull they fastened to the house of Dagon. Dagon was one of their gods, one of their false gods, who couldn't hear or see or speak or do anything. And all those of Jabesh in Gilead got to hear of all that the Philistines had done to Saul. Remember, we heard this already. We read this already in the book of, let me think what book it was. 1 Kings, I think, wasn't it? Yeah, I think so. The end of 1 Kings, I think. So all the valiant men rose up and carried off the corpse of Saul and the corpses of his sons, and brought them to Jabesh and buried their bones under the big tree. Well, we'll be able to look it up right here. Well, there it is. It's 1 Samuel 31 and 12. All the valiant men rose up and went all night long, took the corpse of Saul. So it's the end of 1 Samuel that happened, before the 1st of Kings, which talks about David. Right. So all the valiant men rose up, and they carried off the corpse of Saul and the corpses of his sons, and brought them to Jabesh and buried their bones under the big tree in Jabesh, and they went fasting for 7 days. Thus Saul died for his unfaithfulness with which he had acted faithlessly against Jehovah concerning the word of Jehovah that he had not kept, and also for asking of a spirit medium to make inquiry, and he did not inquire of Yahweh, an alternate pronunciation of Jehovah, because the vowels didn't exist in years past. Consequently, he put him to death and turned the kingship over to David, the son of Jesse. That is, Yahweh put Saul to death, even though he was king of Israel, Jehovah's people. And Yahweh turned the kingship over to David, the son of Jesse, which we already know, of course. But that's the end of 1 Chronicles 10. We'll be now reviewing more of what we've learned, and probably with some added information in the book of 1 Chronicles, information that was not entirely contained in the books of Samuel or 1st or 2nd Kings. So may we move on now to Daniel chapter 11. And before I even start, I want to give the reference so that we don't forget to do it. There's a reference here. The Watchtower from 1959, November 1st, pages 663 to 667. The article is called Part 25, Your Will Be Done on Earth. And this is the explanation from the book Your Will Be Done on Earth from 1959 of who the King of the North and South are, and how that prophecy was worked out, although the Watchtower Society has later written other things as well. And one thing we know is that prophecies have multiple fulfillments and different interpretations at different times. So none of what we learn about the fulfillment of prophecy necessarily remains true over time as we increase in our understanding of what the prophecy really is saying. And it's free to be interpreted the way we want to. Prophecy is, it belongs to God himself. It's his word. Now, chapter 11 of Daniel, verse 1. And as for me, this is, of course, the angel who was speaking to Daniel. In the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up as a strengthener and as a fortress to him. Darius the Mede, we know, was the one who conquered, or who was put in place by the conqueror of Babylon in the year BCE 539. That was the first year of Darius the Mede. Officially, 538 would be his first year, if we go by the accession year system. And now, what is truth I shall tell to you? Verse 2. Look, there will yet be three kings standing up for Persia, and the fourth one will amass greater riches than all others. Xerxes the First in the Insight book appears to be the fourth king mentioned at Daniel 11 and 2. The three preceding ones being Cyrus the Great, Cambyses the Second, and Darius Hystaspes, according to the Insight book under the name, heading name, Ahasuerus. So it's near the beginning of the Insight book, Ahasuerus. And as soon as he has become strong, that is the fourth one, in his riches he will rouse up everything against the kingdom of Greece. Now Xerxes the First evidently did fight against Greece. I seem to remember there was a major war during the time of Xerxes the First. During my own previous research, when I was researching my earlier articles, and a mighty king will certainly stand up and rule with extensive dominion and do according to his will. And when he will have stood up, his kingdom will be broken and be divided toward the four winds of the heavens, but not to his posterity and not according to his dominion with which he had ruled, because his kingdom will be uprooted even for others than these. The mighty king that will stand up is evidently the north, king of the north, because when we read verse 5, it says the king of the south will become strong, even one of his princes, and he will prevail against him and will certainly rule with extensive dominion greater than that one's ruling power. Reference for that under Persia says, following Alexander's death, that is Alexander the Great, who ruled over a huge kingdom including Egypt. He was Pharaoh of Egypt even, as well as many different parts of the world around Greece. Seleucus Nicator obtained control of the major portion with Persia as its central part. The Seleucid dynasty of kings thus begun continued until 64 BCE. So Seleucus Nicator seems to be the one referred to as the king of the north in Daniel's prophecy. But this is the most recent information. When we go down, let's look at the later information in the work from November 1st, 1959, if it's here. Let's see, here it is. Somewhere here. Who's the king of the south? He's one of the princes or military chiefs of Daniel the Great. It says in paragraph 18 of that book, of that chapter, under the heading Rival of the Two Kings, in the chapter part 25, Your Will Be Done on Earth, Watchtower, November 1st, 1959. Paragraph 18, Ptolemy the First, the son of Lagus. He was in fact one of Alexander's bodyguards, and he became the king of Egypt in 306 BCE. The king of the south will become strong. He's the king of the south, evidently. And at the end of some years, they will ally themselves with each other. And the very daughter of the king of the south will come to the king of the north in order to make an equitable arrangement. Now, the king of the south today is like the Ukraine, because we have this war with the king of the north, Russia, invading the Ukraine. So it has different meanings at different times. But she will not retain the power of her arm, and he will not stand, neither his arm, and she will be given up, she herself and those bringing her in, and he who caused her birth and the one making her strong in those times. And one from the sprout of her roots will certainly stand up in his position, and he will come to the military force and come against the fortress of the king of the north, and will certainly act against them and prevail. And also with their gods, with their molten images, with their desirable articles of silver and gold, and with the captives, he will come to Egypt. And he himself will for some years stand off from the king of the north. Fascinating. Sounds like the king of Egypt. And he will actually come into the kingdom of the king of the south and go back to his own soil. Now that's talking about the king of the north coming into the kingdom of the south. The Syrian king, it says here. The king of the Syrian king, the king of Syria, King Seleucus II, entered the Egyptian kingdom and went back to his own soil. It says there, this is from Daniel's prophecy, Two Kings in Conflict, paragraph 23, by the Watchtower Society from, I don't know what year that is. Now, as for his sons, they will excite themselves and actually gather together a crowd of large military forces, and in coming, he will certainly come and flood over and pass through, but he will go back and will excite himself all the way to the fortress, his own fortress. And the king of the south will embitter himself and will have to go forth and fight with him, that is, with the king of the north, and he will certainly have a large crowd stand up. Sounds like Gog and Magog. And the crowd will actually be given into the hand of that one. And the crowd will certainly be carried away. His heart will become exalted. In the book of Ezekiel, Gog and Magog, and also in the book of Revelation, it mentions Gog as well. The crowd will certainly be carried away. His heart will become exalted, and he will actually cause tens of thousands to fall, but he will not use his strong position. And the king of the north must return and set up a crowd larger than the first. And at the end of the time, some years, he will come doing so with a great military force and with a great deal of goods. And in those times, there will be many who will stand up against the king of the south, and the sons of the robbers belonging to your people will for their part be carried along to try to make a vision come true, and they will have to stumble. And the king of the north will come and throw up a siege rampart and actually capture a city with fortifications. It's too much to read it all. There are 40 chapters or something in this chapter. 45 chapters. And it ends by saying, let's read the last portion here. Well, in verse 41, he will actually enter into the land of the decoration. And the land of the decoration was originally the beautiful promised land. And nowadays it means spiritual Israel. So he entered into the place in the modern day, it means he enters into the place of God's people, or into the you know, into the business of God's own witnesses. And there will be many lands that will be made to stumble, but these are the ones that will escape out of his hand: Edom and Moab and the main part of the sons of Ammon. Nowadays would have symbolic meanings, but he will keep thrusting out his hand against the lands. And as regards the land of Egypt, she will not prove to be an escapee. And he will actually rule over the hidden treasures of the gold and the silver and over all the desirable things of Egypt. And the Libyans and the Ethiopians will be at his steps. Oh, that's interesting. We read about the Ethiopians today in the Crucible article, too. But there will be, in much more ancient times than Daniel's time, of course. Moses lived almost 1,000 years before Daniel. But there will be reports that will disturb him out of the sun rising and out of the north. And he will certainly go forth in a great rage in order to annihilate and to devote many to destruction. My breathing is okay now. I'm not choking on any smoke anymore. And he will plant his palatial tents between the Grand Sea and the Holy Mountain of Decoration. Grand Sea used to be the Mediterranean. And the Decoration, the Holy Mountain of Decoration, was Mount Zion, Jerusalem. And he will have to come all the way to his end, and there will be no helper for him. So, when we go back to this previous prophecy, the king of the north and south, which we found before, if we have a little time, we do have a tiny bit of time here. And this book, Thy Will Be Done on Earth, from 1959, is not available online, apparently. It may be available somewhere online, but not from JW.org, from what I was able to find recently, just now when I searched today. Let's look at this reference again. Let's go down to this article. November 1st, 1959, Watchtower, paragraph 18. He was one of Alexander's bodyguards, was Ptolemy the First. He was made the satrap of Egypt, but assumed the title of king in 306 BCE in imitation of one-eyed general Antigonus. He was the first of 13 or 14 Macedonian kings or pharaohs of Egypt. According to his name, Ptolemy, he established the Ptolemaic line of rulers over Egypt. About 312 BCE, he captured Jerusalem. That was before he became the king. On a Sabbath day, he preceded the Jews to come south to Egypt as colonists, and a colony of them was established in Alexandria. With his son and successor, he shared in founding the famous library and museum in Alexandria. That's all for today. It's been great to be with you. The date is February 20th, 2024 of the Common Era, and the time is 23:28 hours Eastern Standard Time, or Eastern Time. I'm Ward Green. I love you very much. And in my behalf, this is Liv Dusty and Cassie saying bye for now.